With the eyes of the world focused on both Eastern Europe and the Middle East, CBS Radio presents Update, a special series of concise, comprehensive, and documented reports on significant forces in today's world. Each week at this time, you'll hear the facts on challenging questions of our time, the political story, the military story, and the human story, recorded by presidents and generals, by ambassadors and reporters, by the men and women who made yesterday's history and today's headlines. Update. Tonight, the Suez Canal. Here to bring you up to date is CBS News correspondent Stuart Novins.
RAF bombers flashed through the Mediterranean haze. French troops were readied for the invasion of Egypt. Meanwhile, British and French statesmen readied their public explanation of this drastic measure. The Suez Canal, said the two governments, is vital to us and it must be protected. The two-day-old war between Israel and Egypt might touch the canal. The waterway might become clogged. Rather than risk that, said Britain and France, they would face the hazards of war. What were the conditions that led up to that decisive moment on the 31st of October? The British and French had been deeply involved with the Suez Canal ever since it was built by a French engineer in 1869. From the beginning, British shipping predominated. It is estimated that 25% of Britain's trade is with countries reached through the canal. Franco-British influence remained strong in the Middle East and consequently strong in the Suez Canal affairs until the recent wave of Arab nationalism threatened them. Under energetic prodding by Egypt's Colonel Nasser, Britain began to evacuate her Suez base in 1954, and she completed the withdrawal last year. In September 1955, Nasser accepted arms from the Soviet bloc. And in Washington and London, there was concern about Soviet penetration into the Middle East. But here is how Nasser justified his act when he was interviewed by Howard K. Smith for the CBS television program See It Now.
We're feeling threat. Us feeling every night that Israel will be able to move and reach Cairo in 4 hours as it was published in your newspaper. I asked America to supply us with arms. We asked Britain, but in vain. 6 months ago, the Israeli hostilities were continuous against our borders. Then I was in a position to ask the other side to supply us. I told the British ambassador and the American ambassador that Russia agreed to supply us. What's your attitude? But they thought that I was bluffing. But I have to supply the Egyptian army with arms to stand against the aggression.
On July 19, the British and Americans withdrew an offer to help Nasser build the high dam across the Nile at Aswan. Some observers saw it as punishment of Nasser for dealing with the Kremlin. On July 26, Nasser was spotlighted by a glaring sun in Alexandria's huge Liberation Square. A pro-Nasser Egyptian reporter, Simon Malley, was among the hundreds of thousands who jammed the square.
I can still remember how the Egyptian president stood firm and determined, but looked calm and serene while his countrymen cheered him and the revolution he symbolized. President Nasser spoke of the way the Western powers, including the United States of America, tried to squeeze economically the Egyptian people. He spoke particularly of the rejection by the United States of the Aswan Dam offer of assistance. And he spoke at length about how Egypt was ready to cope with the situation by other ways and by other forms. Then suddenly he announced the nationalization of the Suez Canal Company. People cheered, applauded, threw their faces in the air, kissed each other. They all felt as if something which they never expected in their life had just happened. Later he told me, "My heart was beating fast these historical hours." But what he didn't tell me was that the hearts of millions of Egyptians, and indeed hundreds of millions of Asians and Africans throughout the world, were also beating fast in pride and contentment. To the overwhelming majority of the Egyptian people, this action didn't mean much in terms of immediate economic advantages. To them, it was a strike against foreign domination.
The British Broadcasting Corporation carried this commentary by a Foreign Office spokesman.
The word Suez, you see, is a very peculiar word over here. It had a special and very romantic place in our history for something like 100 years. In two world wars, people from the British Isles, from all over the Commonwealth, have fought and died in order to keep Suez out of hostile hands. Now, the Egyptians argue that they're just taking over an Egyptian country, and that the canal would be perfectly all right even after nationalization. The issue here is not nationalization. It's whether the president of Egypt is going to be allowed to set an example to other governments in the Middle East in tearing up an international agreement. Well, the view here is that if he gets away with it, the Western powers will lose what influence they still have in the Middle East. And with it, there will go the oil that is the foundation of our power and prosperity.
Britain, France, and the United States called a conference in London of 24 nations to set up international control for the Suez Canal. John Foster Dulles outlined the U.S. position to the American people over a nationwide television hookup.
We believe that out of this conference will come a plan for the international operation of the canal, and that the canal will continue to be operated by those who feel that it is their duty to serve the international community and not to serve the special interests of any one nation. It's one thing for a nation to defy just one or two other nations. But it's quite a different thing to defy the considered and sober judgment of many nations, nations which have treaty rights in the canal. Now, I've been asked, what will we do if the conference fails? My answer to that is that we are not thinking in terms of the conference failing.
But the conference did fail in its aim of internationalizing the Suez Canal. Nasser would not accept it. Negotiations dragged on for months, stalemated. In October, the Suez dispute was added to the agenda of the United Nations, but Egypt would not yield on the crucial point of internationalization. Suddenly, another long smoldering spark was reignited in the Middle East. Israel flung her military forces across the Egyptian border, she said, to attack bases of terrorist raiders. The UN called an emergency session. Egypt's permanent UN representative, Omar Lutfi, opened the debate with his country's charges. During the night of October 29th, says Mr. Lutfi, Israel committed the most serious act of unprovoked armed aggression that has taken place since the conclusion of the armistice of 1949. Mr. Lutfi speaks of a British ultimatum which demanded that the Egyptians and the Israelis remove their troops, cease fighting, and withdraw 10 miles from the Suez Canal, and that they agree to an occupation by the British and French of Egyptian territory. Mr. Lutfi says that his government rejects this ultimatum. He calls on the UN to condemn the British air raids on Egypt, but he concludes, in the meantime, Egypt will fight to defend itself. During the same night, Israeli delegate Abba Iban claimed justification for his country's move. It was self-defense, he said, made necessary by Egyptian attacks.
Stretching back far behind the events of this week lies the unique and somber story of a small people, subjected throughout all the years of its national existence to a furious, implacable, comprehensive campaign of hatred and siege, for which there is no parallel or precedent in the modern history of nations. What we confront tonight is a point of explosion after 7 years of illicit belligerency. Egypt has held belligerency to be the spiritual and emotional mainspring of her conduct towards Israel. Out of this belligerency, maintained with special vigor and intensity since the rise of the Nasser regime, is born the crisis which the Assembly of the United Nations confronts tonight.
As the debate continued in New York, there were swift developments in the Middle East. Israel overran and sealed off the Gaza Strip. The RAF pounded Egyptian airfields. Egypt reported that the Suez Canal had been blocked by a bombed ship. When the United Nations demanded a ceasefire and a withdrawal of forces, Britain and France said they could not agree so long as the Suez Canal was not safeguarded. Prime Minister Anthony Eden had to defend his position against mounting criticism at home and abroad.
All my life, I've been a man of peace, working for peace, striving for peace, negotiating for peace. I've been a League of Nations man and a United Nations man. And I'm still the same man, with the same conviction, the same devotion to peace. I couldn't be other, even if I wished, but I'm utterly convinced that the action we have taken is right.
But there were many Britons who remained opposed. This crowd in London's Trafalgar Square chants, Eden must go. The Prime Minister's political opponents in the opposition Labour Party were vehement in their denunciation. The crowd in Trafalgar Square listened to Labourite Aneurin Bevan, famous for his scathing tongue.
Sir Anthony Eden has been pretending that he is now invading Egypt in order to strengthen the United Nations. Every burglar, of course, could say the same thing. Or if Mr. Anthony Eden is sincere in what he is saying, and he may be, then if he is sincere in what he is saying, then he is too stupid to be a prime minister.
In the UN General Assembly on November 1st, Canadian Foreign Minister Lester Pearson proposed a plan that would, he said, end hostilities and guarantee protection of the canal.
The armed forces of Israel and of Egypt are to withdraw, or if you like, to return to the armistice lines, where they will presumably, if this is done, once again face each other in fear and hatred. Such a return would not be to a position of security, but be a return to terror, bloodshed, and ultimately another explosion, which a United Nations Armistice Commission will be futile to prevent and possibly even to investigate. I would have liked to see in this resolution a provision authorizing the Secretary General to begin to make arrangements with member governments for a United Nations force, a truly international peace and police force.
But London and Paris were going ahead with their own plans to occupy Suez themselves. General Sir Charles Keeley, commander of the joint force, outlined his mission.
The mission I have been given is to clear a 10-mile area either side of the canal straight down. And we shall do this both on the east and the west.
The invasion began on November 5th. There was an airdrop at Port Said at the head of the canal. RAF Group Captain Brian McNamara participated in that action. Here's how he saw it.
We made a landfall a little late, but we were able to catch up time and did our drop on a very good dropping zone, which was easily identifiable. It was perhaps a little hazy with the sun shining in the haze into our eyes. No fighter opposition of any sort. We had a little bit of anti-aircraft fire, and they were actually shelling us. They were dropping shells in the water quite close to us when they turned away. We went down low on the water. I understand there has been a little bit of damage.
At the United Nations, a dozen countries pledged troops to the UN police force just being formed. Radio Cairo broadcast an appeal for aid. There was a response from the Soviet Union. CBS News correspondent Daniel Shore was reporting on this development in a direct transmission from Moscow when the censor cut him off.
The Middle Eastern crisis has taken a grave new turn tonight. I am reliably informed that the Egyptian embassy here has received orders from Cairo to ask for the volunteers that Russia has offered, and that this request is being relayed to the Soviet government. If the Soviet statements of recent days mean anything, the request will be complied with. A reserve lieutenant colonel was quoted in the Soviet press today as saying, "I am ready with weapons in my hands." There is reason to believe that the volunteers will be formed into units here and receive their equipment here. An Egyptian source told me, "We don't have equipment for them in Egypt." The volunteers include 265
The censor interrupted. but Shaw was allowed later to continue after deleting details about the troops. The threat of Soviet volunteers moving into the Middle East was brought up at President Eisenhower's press conference.
You have said it is the duty of all the United Nations members, including the United States, to oppose the introduction of any new forces in the Middle East. Does this apply to the intervention on the side of Egypt by so-called volunteers from the Soviet Union or Communist China?
I believe we said that the introduction of any armed forces in the area of conflict or arms or munitions. So I am not going to say that the United States would make a unilateral determination of exactly what the offense was, if any. I believe I stated that it would be the duty of the United Nations, which would include the United States, to oppose such an effort. If the United Nations, we would again try to be their supporters in any such action.
The Soviet Union did not follow through on its threat to send volunteers. Daniel Shaw, the correspondent who was cut off by the Moscow censor, was recently in New York. He had these retrospective views of what happened and why.
The Soviet threat to send volunteers to Egypt last November can only be understood against the background of events in Russia at that time. The Hungarian rebellion had got out of hand. The Russian people, even though denied details, were getting restless. The Soviet government needed something to divert their attention, and a war scare in the Middle East seemed the perfect answer. The threat to send the volunteers looked to us like a calculated risk. The threat was made only after the ceasefire in Egypt, when it was already probable that British, French, and Israeli troops would have to pull out. Undoubtedly, the Soviet leaders figured that by threatening to send volunteers, they would get a propaganda victory at a very cheap price. The credit for forcing a withdrawal that was undoubtedly going to take place anyway, which is not to say that it was a bluff. Western observers in Moscow believe that if the Russians had been called on their threat, if the invaders had stayed in Egypt, the Russians would have gone through with their threat, if only to avoid losing face. I don't think the Russians wanted to do it, especially after President Eisenhower warned that such an action would be countered by the United States. I don't think they expected to have to do it, but I do think they would have gone through with it if they did have to.
2 days after the invasion had begun, the Anglo-French command announced that they controlled the north quarter of the canal. But the canal itself was now blocked with ships scuttled by the Egyptians. By November 8th, correspondents reported that all major fighting had stopped. Great Britain announced that she would now observe the UN ceasefire. That same day, November 8th, UN Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld was able to report this compliance to reporters in New York.
Her Majesty's government are ordering their forces to cease fire at midnight Greenwich Mean Time unless they are attacked.
Later, Hammarskjöld announced that the first units of the United Nations Emergency Force would fly to Egypt to take over occupation of the Suez Canal zone. The first contingent arrived on November 15th. CBS News correspondent Lou Chaffee describes the tumultuous welcome given to the UN police force in Port Said.
The first United Nations troops are now coming out of the station. They're marching down the street. The Egyptian crowds are surging forward. They're surging forward around the UN troops, waving their arms, cheering, smiling, welcoming them. And they're cheering, shouting anti-British slogans and pro-Egyptian slogans. Over the heads of the UN troops, you can see hats, hands, handkerchiefs being waved in greeting to these United Nations forces. 175 men, 15 officers from Norway, they march in orderly file, columns of five, down through the streets while crowds of cheering, waving Egyptians greet them to Port Said.
A British commander smartly saluted a Danish officer representing the UN force, and this is how they talked about the practical details of handing over the command.
You'll move your train in at this moment. We'll put the front of it at the back of the position, so then the whole position you can take over.
Yes.
Would you like to bring your train in?
I think that actually I want to unload where the train is now.
Would you rather march through?
Well, yes, you know, I'd have to unload in the middle of the train, in the middle of the zone.
Well,
that's most practical for me.
I see. Whichever you prefer.
So
I don't
think,
mind.
I think that...
Yes.
Whatever's
convenient
there.
To you. Can bring the train into lines if you like, if you find it better. You can do whatever you prefer. What?
How many platoons have you?
We have about 3 platoons.
3.
Yes. And you are going to send one platoon over the canal, are you?
One platoon over the canal, and one platoon this area, and one platoon...
Yes.
A different side of it.
All right.
Yes.
Well, if you'd like to bring in your leading platoon, we'll hand it over the leading position
yes,
now.
But it will take some time because we'll first have to unload the train. That's the first requirement,
right.
I think.
The guns were stilled, but the Suez Canal was blocked with sunken ships. Western Europeans, including the British and French, saw their worst fears realized. The flow of oil to run their industries was cut off. Here is how U.S. defense mobilizer Arthur Fleming explained the problem.
The present problem is essentially a transportation problem. The number of tankers available to carry oil is not sufficient to permit maintaining oil consumption at normal levels everywhere in the world. The United States desires to cooperate as fully as possible in lessening the effects of the present situation in both producing and consuming countries. But there will remain, in all probability, shortages, for example, in Europe, of approximately 25%, which cannot be overcome as long as the Suez Canal remains closed and the pipelines are unrepaired.
Another consequence of this short but significant war was an Arab-Israeli clash over what happened to an estimated 25,000 Jewish residents of Egypt. At the United Nations, Israeli delegate Abba Iban made this charge.
The Jewish population in Egypt, without distinction of nationality, is being subjected on a purely racial basis to persecution, and a great number have been deprived of their liberty and are held in detention, many of them in concentration camps. The Jews are now being deported from Egypt en masse.
The rebuttal before the UN was delivered by Egyptian Foreign Minister Mohamed Fawzi. He dismissed the charge in two words.
Just rumors. And worse than that, manufactured rumors. Mr. President and fellow delegates, this is just one more cycle of a maneuver through which Israel, and obviously its two illustrious associates, are indulging. It is a cycle of a war of attrition and of slander against Egypt.
Now, what did Britain, France, and Israel gain or lose by this operation against Egypt? Here is the point of view of a correspondent whose beat is the Middle East, Claire Sterling of Reporter magazine.
It seems obvious, but it is not accurate to say that Britain, France, and Israel have lost everything they'd set out to gain, and much more, in their two-week war with Egypt. They have lost a very great deal. Money, production, trade, honor, international prestige. And they've come very close to losing their indispensable ally, the United States. They've been dispossessed in Egypt, a human tragedy for the 45,000 Jews who've been living there, a financial tragedy for the British and French, who had $1.5 billion invested there. They've suffered military setbacks everywhere, in Jordan, where British base rights now hang on a thread, in Aden, where the Yemenites are attacking with Russian arms, in Syria, where Russia has set up the equivalent of a military base, in Iraq, the heart of the Baghdad Pact, where a pro-Western government has been all but drowned in a flood of anti-Western sentiment. And in exchange for all this, they've apparently gained nothing. They have not kept the Suez Canal open. Egyptian sabotage, in fact, has closed it down for 6 months. They have not forced Nasser to accept international control of the canal. And far from bringing about the fall of Nasser himself, they seem to have made a colossus of the man who has laid threatening hands on Britain's lifeline and covetous eyes on 70% of the West's oil supply. But Britain, France, and Israel have not lost their war irrevocably, and Nasser has not yet won it. Before the Egyptian ruler can claim total victory, he must get back the Gaza Strip and the Straits of Turan. He must get the UN troops off his territory and remain in undisputed control of the Suez Canal. And he must repair his wrecked economy.
Although the consequence of British Prime Minister Sir Anthony Eden's decision had not been what he had hoped, Eden continued to argue his case. Verging on collapse because of fatigue, he took a short rest in the West Indies. Upon his return to London, Eden said,
I know many had heavy hearts when they learned that Britain and France had taken independent action. But we did what the United Nations, without a police force, could not do in the time. And I say to you, to this great company,
But after a lifetime spent in foreign affairs, I am sincerely and deeply convinced of this. If we had not acted, the whole Middle East would be in flames tonight.
But the criticism continued, harsh and unabated. On January 9, Sir Anthony, in an audience with Queen Elizabeth in Buckingham Palace, handed in his resignation. He explained that his poor health made it impossible for him to carry the burden any longer. The public's reaction to Eden's resignation was recorded by the BBC in London.
I think it's a disgrace, actually, because he's done a bad job. He should have gone right ahead when he went into Egypt. He stopped halfway. I mean, it's in for a penny, in for a pound. If he's going in, he should have gone in and taken the whole thing. Then he would have got what he wanted at his terms, not in NASA's terms.
It's about time the man did get out.
Quite right. Eden should retire now. Otherwise, he might keep the bucket.
I'm terribly sorry for him, but I really do think that it's the best thing he could have done.
Well, I think it's a pretty rough deal he had when the Americans won't support him in. Now, we're out, the Americans want to go in. We shan't get a better man than that, Eden, as Prime Minister.
One positive consequence of this crisis over Suez was the creation of the United Nations Emergency Force. The main responsibility for organizing the so-called UNEF fell on Undersecretary General Ralph Bunche. Dr. Bunche talks about the significance of this unique police force.
In the first place, the United Nations force in Egypt is the first UN force organized and commanded by the United Nations. Secondly, because in this United Nations Emergency Force, there is certainly the most remarkable demonstration of international cooperation at work that human history has ever seen. Thirdly, because this force has demonstrated quite convincingly the ability of the United Nations to act concretely, effectively, and quickly. The United Nations force was the firm basis for making the ceasefire in Egypt secure by being interposed between the lines. The main unique problem was to be found in the fact that those of us who had responsibility for organizing and directing the force were uniquely inexperienced in military and military organizational matters. It has instilled a new confidence in people that the United Nations has the ability to act decisively and constructively in the face of the most desperate emergency.
Out of this seething cauldron of the Middle East, a cauldron that could bubble over into a world war, has now come the emergence of a more definite United States policy. But whatever policies are adopted in the world's political capitals or in the United Nations, one fact has been vividly dramatized for today's generation of Americans. The Middle East, an area which in the past has been taken for granted, touches us and is of vital concern to us at home. What happens in Cairo, Egypt, affects Cairo, Illinois. What happens in Baghdad is important to Birmingham. And what happens in Tel Aviv touches Tallahassee.